This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. The Mark Reardon Show.
We call my plan Bidenomics. Guess what?
It's working.
I will say that there have been so many accomplishments under this administration, it can be difficult to list them in a distilled way.
I do not hate anyone. So I say this gently. The Biden administration sucks.
This is the Mark Reardon Show.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome into the Mark Reardon Show. If you're listening and you're saying, wait a second, that doesn't sound like Reardon, well, you'd be correct. I'm Ethan Hannaford, the associate producer for both the Annie Fry Show and the Mark Reardon Show. I'm joined today by the one and only Sue Thomas. Sue, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you, Ethan.
Pleasure to have you on joining me for this day after Christmas, and we'll be talking plenty here in the next couple of minutes about some of our recaps from the last couple of days. It was nice having the day off yesterday, getting to spend some time with family, but if you're wondering where Mark is, that's exactly where he is. He's with family. He's off for the next several days up until New Year's Day. He'll be back on January 2nd, and until then, Sue and I will be guiding you through some of the most memorable segments from throughout 2024. We in radio call these best of segments, and we have some pretty good ones, I think, that we have lined up for you. Just to give you a little sneak peek of what we have today, we're going to be playing some interviews that Mark has had over the last several months with Garrett Price, Bob Gale, one of the creators of Back to the Future, the one and only Frank Cusimano, and several more. So looking forward to hearing some of the most enjoyable interviews from the 2024 year. But Sue, before we get into the best ofs, December 25th has passed now. December 26th is kind of a little bit of a depressing day because it's kind of like the day that you look forward to for so long has passed a little bit. Obviously, some people still have their time off. For some people, though, it's back to work. How was your Christmas Eve and Christmas Day?
It was really nice. Here's the thing. If it were sunny today, we could all say, oh, okay. But it isn't. It's dreary and it's rainy, which it was yesterday. How was your surf and turf, by the way?
Oh, don't get me started on the surf and turf. It was top two meals of the year, and it wasn't number two, Sue. It was not number two. It was the best meal that I have had all year. Mama Wendy, she cooked it up, and she killed the game. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Man, that sounds so good.
But going back to what you said about the weather, I agree with you. Cloudy, you know, you're kind of used to the cloudy at this time of year, but it's the rain, and it's the rain in the like 45 degrees. Like if you're gonna have rain, like at least have it be a little bit. Now, obviously, for the roads, you don't want it to be super cold, but you know, at least, you know, have it feel a little bit more wintry for Christmas. It kind of gets you into that mood. But nope, none of that today. It is soggy, I think is probably the best word to describe how it feels out right now. And that's kind of how it's been the last couple of days. Not really, you know, no white Christmas once again this year. And yeah, just kind of soggy weather, Sue.
All right, here's what we did yesterday in the sog. We went to Grafton.
Okay.
The home of my now in-laws. And we had a really nice, what they do there and what we've done there for years is we have a mushroom souffle. So we had a souffle, and I baked homemade rolls, which turned out well. So we had this homemade bread, and we had the delicious souffles, and that was really nice. One of the things, you know, we do the usual Christmas, and that's fun. But at one point during the meal, my mother-in-law says, oh, you know what? I have some stuff of Michael's up in, you know, the attic. And there's some boxes of him. I'm going to go ahead and transfer those to you, and you guys can put that in your new house. And I said, that's fine. Of course, we're not in that house yet, but I figure we'll drive around with it in the trunk for a while.
Sure.
Okay. And she said, oh, I think I have your B coat, she says to Michael, from fifth grade.
Fifth grade?
And, okay, apparently he loved this coat.
Okay.
And it's striped with, it's just a yellow stripe and blue stripe. It was the first down coat he ever got in the 70s. And if you lived in the 70s like the rest of us, not even, down was kind of a new thing, and it was cool, and you were like, ooh, can I get one eventually?
Okay.
And I never did. I mean, I had the fake stuff for a long time. But when he was in fifth grade, he must have gotten it for something. So we trek up there, dig around in the boxes, and find his B coat, and sure enough, it fits me.
Oh, my gosh.
So I am in love with this thing. Now, I can't get the smell of 50 years of box off of it for right now. So I put it through the washer twice, and I now have it hanging outside trying to air it out. And, of course, there's no sunshine to help me with this.
Right. Well, you got a sog today.
Yes, I've got sog. But this thing, Ethan, is so cute. I sent it to you. Would you look at that picture and say to me, oh, does that look like an old coat or does it look cool?
I'm clicking on it right now. I tell you what, that I like
it's
it.
Awesome.
I think you're rocking it, Sue. I think the funniest part is that he wore this when, how old was he? 11?
How old are you in fifth grade?
Yeah, you're 11 years
yes.
old. So he wore this when he was 11 and it fits you perfectly now. That is just so telling.
Isn't that cute?
That is adorable. That is and it fits the name. You look like a bumblebee.
Yes. So I'm going to wear the bee coat now. And think that it's really awesome. There's a little bit of the zipper that probably needs to be reattached.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was one of my favorite things from the entire holiday.
Well, let me ask you this. So, you know, obviously you do the gift giving and everything. You know, where did this compare? Because this wasn't technically a gift,
no.
but I'm sure in your mind it feels like one. Where does this compare?
It's pretty high up on the list. I got some another thing I like. He points out this to me. I'm in a kind of a furry fuzz phase. In other words,
okay.
like that Steelers jacket I have that's fuzzy.
Yep.
And I have a purse that's fuzzy. I'm in a fuzzy phase.
Okay.
And I've got a kind of a jacket that is longer and made out of more fuzz. And I really like that. But the B coat is high up there.
That
How about yours?
Is hilarious. I love that for you. Great Christmas. Chris, you know, I've said this. As I've gotten older and I've matured a little bit more, I think that I have grown to enjoy Christmas Eve more than actually Christmas Day.
They were
both pretty close. Our church did a service on December 23rd this year, I think, to give everyone the night off for Christmas Eve for the first time that I can ever remember. But it was a very nice Christmas Eve. We like to go to Alton and we look at on Henry Street, which is old historic Alton. A lot of pretty big houses up there. They lined the sidewalks with these luminaries, and
now
they look
luminaries rock.
Yeah, they're so pretty. They're just just homemade ones. Just white lunch bags with that they fill with sand and put candles in them, and they just look so pretty lining all of Henry Street and Alton. We've been doing that where we drive through and look at all the houses and the luminaries for at least 10 years, probably more like 15 with my family. So that was very enjoyable. Had some
That's
great
cool.
food. We had a great, I told you guys about our brunch that we had on Christmas Eve where my mom made the French toast strata and with the breakfast casseroles. And I'm telling you what, Sue, next time I might have to get you in on the invite list because this food, knowing you, the food connoisseur, we need to get you on that list. But and then Christmas Day was great. A lot of fun gifts. My first, for both of us, but
yes.
Well, I guess,
no, yours counts more than mine.
Well,
I get it.
First one with my now wife, and first one with your husband, I guess, as a married couple. So congratulations to you. But yeah, it was very sweet just having her be a part of some really enjoyable traditions and, very nice, very sweet time. I told Ryan earlier, we had good food, good gifts, bad football, but is there any such thing as really bad football? I mean, football on Christmas Day.
Steelers, it was ugly.
Yeah, it's tough. We'll talk about it, I'm sure, a little bit later here. But no, it's good to hear that you had a wonderful Christmas, and I'm sure that Mark had a great Christmas. We saw a picture of Alexa in front of their giant tree, and she looked like she was having a ball of a time. Did she not, Sue?
Yes.
Yeah, so no doubt about that there, and I'm sure we'll hear it from Mark at some point here in these next handful of days. But let's go ahead and let's move into our first best of segment. Listen, if you're a regular listener of the show, you know that Mark has gone on and on a couple of different times about when he's almost gotten scammed. And I know you've kind of been in on this with him as well.
This is fascinating.
So anything to do with scammers, you both get intrigued.
And yes.
In this upcoming segment, Mark and Sue discuss a series that the Washington Post is doing on people getting scammed. And Mark goes through one of those situations here.
We love these scammer stories, and I've admitted a couple of times there was one that almost got me recently that was an email that I got from supposedly the United States Postal Service, and if you remember correctly, Sue, I was waiting for a package at the time, so...
As most people are. This is why this works.
Right, so I wasn't maybe as on guard as I should have been, and I started feeling... It said the claim was my package is delayed, there's some postage owed.
There was a problem with your address.
Yeah, yeah.
That was what it was.
But they wanted me to fill out credit card information, and as soon as that happened, then I went back to the email, and I looked at the email address,
and it was
all goofy.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in this case. Now, the Washington Post is, I think they're doing like a series called Scam.
Oh, this is going to be good.
And this one is from, I think I might have missed part one and two, but this is part three, and it's about a woman by the name of Judith Boivin. And now you tell me who's to blame here. In October of last year, she calls her branch of Morgan Stanley with an unusual request. And even the people at the bank, you know, knew something was wrong. She wanted them to empty out her retirement account.
No.
Well, right. They pressed her for details, and the more they asked her for details, the more suspicious they became.
Ooh.
One investigator used the duck line on her: if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then it's probably a duck, but to no avail. So this is what's interesting, and the way that they frame this in the Washington Post is, and you're going to hear some audio from her here that I think will kind of stun you, because Judith doesn't realize that she's being manipulated, right? You become so conditioned to see what the scammer wants you to see that, and especially with older people, I think you become a little confused. So this is an explanation in this article and in some of the audio, I guess, they try to offer an explanation as to why nobody at Morgan Stanley could dissuade this woman who's a retired therapist from draining $600,000 out of her account.
Mark.
They even told her huge tax consequences.
Yes.
But she had a coach, and this coach had convinced her that she was helping the FBI bring down a Mexican cartel's drug and money laundering operation, and that she needed to move all of her money into a government locker to ensure that it wouldn't get tangled up in the criminal case. And she believed him when he said that she'd get it all back after the trial.
Oh, this is... Now, first of all, the FBI is never going to call you and ask you for money.
The FBI is also not going to send you an email that doesn't have an FBI.gov email address. And this is another one of those things that when she, you know, when you look back at that, you see the email address. Judith says, well, why, how would I know that? But here's what she told the Washington Post. Listen.
Because the financial institution refused to release my money, and it put me on the defensive. And I would tell him they are not willing to release this. And then he would say very calmly and in very authoritative kind of terms, they will have to allow you to take out your money because it is your money.
Was he coaching you? It sounds like
coaching.
He was coaching you.
And then he told me what the story I needed to give.
So the scammer knew that, you know, if you're going to go to Morgan Stanley and you're going to try to cash out $600,000 and deposit in a bank, well, no, the people are going to be suspicious, right? So that's going to draw scrutiny. So this is what he does. He has her divide the money and deposit it in four financial institutions with Maryland branches: Capital One, JP Morgan Chase, PNC Bank, and TD Bank. She was then directed to make cash withdrawals of $10,000 to $20,000 at a time.
This is hideous.
It's awful, but listen to her, because you got to hear what she actually sounds like. She wants to make people think that this is nothing. She has no blame in this whatsoever.
Mm.
Now, I have a hard time believing that. She goes, the hardest part was going to the banks day after day and day after day asking for huge amounts of money. So she goes on and she does this for a long time, right?
The banks locally should have called me aside. They should have taken me to a back room and asked a lot of questions before they would do anything.
Okay. But they kind of did, right?
Yeah.
The guy tells her to say, tell them the money would be used to remodel an Airbnb in Tennessee.
What?
He then provides her with doctored paperwork, an invoice for a new roof. I mean, this is sophisticated, right? Vents, $39,600. Flooring and carpets for $34,000. It's all fictitious from a contractor named Bradley Handyman Pro. She was supposed to tell anyone who asked that she got a large discount on the work if she paid cash.
Okay, I have a question. How did he fish her in to begin with? What would make her think that this was really happening?
That he was the FBI?
Yes. Yes. Why would she think that?
Well, because he convinced her that he was an FBI agent. She said, the story says she never wavered or felt fear because she believed FBI agents were watching every drop-off. Plus, her handler would remain on the phone with her the entire time. I'm telling you, Sue, these things get so sophisticated. But again, she, I think, has a little responsibility here as well.
It just wasn't a good feeling. And they can say how much they put into trying to stop me from now until the cows come home. But I'm afraid it doesn't land.
Yeah.
Oh, you might be scammed. You might be involved in a scam.
But that's not enough, is what you're saying. That's not enough to shake you out of the ether. That's
no.
That's how the experts explain it, that they put you in this ether. He's in your pocket.
The conviction of the FBI, that was the ether that I was surrounded with. And the doing something for a better good.
Yeah, but I understand the ether. But look, the story makes it very clear that Chase even says they were telling her over and over that you are the victim of a very sophisticated scam. So what else are people supposed to do?
Thank you. That's what I was going
to
say.
She wants to be pulled into a back room. She essentially was pulled into a back room. And they said over and over again, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. This is a scam. And then they said, look, there's big tax implications. But nothing was big enough to shake her out of this.
I did not get one word about an example of a scam.
And what would that example look like?
If these people were informed, and this is a financial institution, it's not just a regular bank, and they would have been informed of the magnitude of scams that are coming out and that most current, could have said, well, we've had scams from the Homeland Security. We've had military frauds.
So it was that
any of those examples could have rang a bell in my head.
Look, she says she says, had they been more personal and descriptive about what a scam could look like.
I kind of get that.
But come on. She says that she felt like she was being judged as a crazy old lady. I think she's coming off as a crazy old lady because she wasn't taking the advice and paying the attention. For those of you listening, especially our older listeners, like my friend Jeff Drew, elderly people, I hope he's listening right now. I really do. Here's an idea. Don't drain your retirement account
ever
when someone asks you to do it via an email.
Yeah.
Ever, ever,
or
ever.
Or if they call you, the answer is no.
Here's the next part. I got to go back and read part one and two because that was part three. Here's part four out today. They talk about Judith again, but they also talk about other people here that were scammed in the same way. And you had 12 victims along with Judith, and the losses spiked to $2.9 million. So she lost $600,000.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And this is, they get into a little bit more detail here into how some of this works, you know, with the person. So there's a guy that says, let me walk you through this. After the first phone call with a man that says he's Special Agent Wayne Jacobs, Judith searched for him online.
Okay.
She found his name. Of course, because
of course,
he goes up online.
Yeah,
exactly. He's just taking the name of someone that's online. So she did look up online. She said that she hadn't been talking to the bona fide Jacobs. He'd never heard of Judith until I contacted an FBI spokesperson. I later told Jacobs how a con man, this is the reporter from the Washington Post, had co-opted his resume as part of a multi-state impersonation scam. And they go into details here because with Jacobs as his avatar, okay, the con man had an unimpeachable backstory. This is what they say. The real agent got his start in 2003 at the field office in New York of the FBI. He worked on government and financial fraud cases. He was later promoted to a special agent in the Criminal Investigative Division in Washington. He took over the field office in Philadelphia. But in other words, it looked real because this was a guy that was investigating financial fraud cases, right? Also, they name-dropped other members of law enforcement.
Well, sure. These are sophisticated people.
Right.
Here's the thing. She could have, I mean, she has a point, right? It's not the onus of the bank or the financial institutions to prevent her from doing that. They tried. But if one of them were trained a little bit more to say, this is how we see it, she has a point there. I'm not saying it's their fault.
No, I get it. I do.
But,
I understand that.
I think personalizing it would probably help some of these people. And it usually is elderly people.
Yeah, it is.
For this kind of stuff. But remember, we've heard these before of younger people because they go online and find out how many kids they have. Where's their kid at school? Maybe that kid has been faux kidnapped, or you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
When they put people in these really stressful situations.
So in this case, this, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I read part three. That was where I pulled the audio because they have the interview pieces. I had not read part four, but as I, you know, kind of go over part four, they get into some more of the details about what happened to Judith, because part four is not only about her, it's about all the people that kind of fell under the same scam. So they say that this was going on for months, right? And as I mentioned just a minute ago, they were name-dropping other members of law enforcement. So at one point, she thinks that she's on the phone with members of the Rockville, Maryland Police Force and then-Chief Victor Brito. And, you know, the reporter for the Washington Post goes to the Rockville City Police Department and says, hey, was this anything that you guys did? Well, of course it wasn't, right? Because it was a scam. And the spokesperson said, oh, actually, this is the new chief there. This is disturbing. I can assure you that no member of the executive command staff of the Rockville City Police Department would ever make a direct call like that and refer someone to a government agency.
Oh.
That just would not happen. So there are a lot of lessons here, right?
Yeah.
Don't trust. You get an email. You're suspicious. Don't give your social. Don't give your credit card information. Don't drain your bank account. Some of these things are pretty simple, and then you're going to be okay. But that seems like a pretty interesting series.
Yes, it does.
In the Washington Post. Now, I rip modern-day journalism all the time, but every once in a while, they land on something interesting, and they did here in the Washington Post.
Sue, I'm curious, before we go to a break real quick, what percentage would you say was the old lady there at fault in that situation?
Here's the thing. The FBI is not going to ask you for your money to help in a case. It is a federal organization. Now, she should know that, but I also feel badly that she got fished in. I'm going to say most of the onus is on her. I'm going to go 80-20.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, obviously, there's part of that is, you know, common sense. I think a large part of it's common sense. I was curious of your opinion because you were in on that conversation with Mark, so thank you very much for that. All right, we're going to be coming back here in just a moment, and when we return, we're going to play an interview that Mark had with Garrett Price, who was the director of Yacht Rock, a documentary, and Lord knows that Mark went crazy over that thing when it released several weeks ago, so we will have that for you coming right up. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. I'm Ethan Hannaford, filling in as Mark enjoys his time off. We're taking you through some of the most memorable segments from the 2024 year. And with that, we now play an interview that Mark had with Garrett Price, the editor and director known for his work for Daisy Jones and The Six, Under the Bridge, and Yacht Rock, a documentary. And in this case, Price joined to discuss his Yacht Rock documentary that Mark absolutely loved.
So I went and saw Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band with my dear friend John Lynch in Kansas City, and we made the decision, he had a Tesla Model S, and we made the decision to just drive back after the show. We weren't ready to sleep. We were thinking about, you know, staying in a hotel. And Tesla has this Yacht Rock station, and John put it on, and we're about the same age, and we listened to stuff like this the whole ride back. Like Christopher Cross and stuff like that, Ambrosia, 10cc. These were all things I played on the radio 40 years ago. Lo and behold, there is a new documentary, and it is fantastic. It's on Max right now. You should watch it. It's called Yacht Rock. Garrett Price, who is the director, is with us this afternoon. Hey, Garrett, how are you? Thanks for coming on here in St. Louis on 97.1 FM Talk.
Hey, Mark. Thanks so much for having me, man.
Let me start by saying this is a wonderful documentary, soothing and nostalgically comfortable, not unlike the genre that you're exploring here.
I appreciate it. I went in wanting to make a documentary that felt like a nice, warm hug for so many people. And I, The response has been overwhelmingly positive, so I appreciate you saying that.
It really is cool. Now, look, in my you're younger than me. You're about my wife's age because you were born, I think, in 1979. I did a little research. That was the time period where all this was kind of taking off. And it was interesting. You got a guy by the name, I think his name is Mac DeMarco, who's featured, and he said of Yacht Rock, it sits in a certain zone. It's not that it doesn't rock. It doesn't rock too hard. It doesn't rock, but it rocks, right? That says a lot right there, I think, Garrett.
Absolutely. I just want to, you know, I think everyone has their own kind of definition of what this music is. And I wanted to get like these contemporary modern musicians and talk about this music that has influenced them. I think it adds a whole level of legitimacy to the sound and its importance in history of music.
So let's talk about the definition of the genre, because when I was starting in radio and playing these songs, you know, in the early 80s and in mid 80s, we called it adult contemporary, light rock, soft rock. So the whole yacht rock thing caught me off guard in the past few years. Sirius XM has a station. I mentioned Tesla. Then I learned in your movie where this all came from this web series in the mid 2000s, right?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. This low budget web series created these kind of, you know, alt history satire vignettes about these artists making this really smooth, polished music in Southern California. And it kind of caught like wildfire. And they, you know, retroactively created this genre. But they had specific rules for this music and parameters. And it kind of makes sense as a subgenre of soft rock when you start to kind of break it down like this. You know, this is like well-produced, polished, smooth music, heavily infused with jazz and R&B, being made in Southern California by these world-class session players. And when you start to look at it that way, a lot of people, I think, that kind of put in this yacht rock category, like your Fleetwood Mac and your Eagles, you can kind of push back that they don't quite, you know, follow under all those rules. And it makes sense as a genre. There's relatively few people making this music, and they were all interconnected at that time. And I wanted to really highlight that in the film.
You know, and I knew a fair amount about the intersectionality because I was a radio guy and I was a music guy. I worked in the record business in the early 1980s. So, for example, we'll get into Toto here a little bit. I knew about the Beccaro brothers and Steve Lukather and how they played. You know, I think even in the movie you kind of describe them as a bit of a wrecking crew of the 1970s, the late 1970s. These guys were some of the best studio musicians out there, and they played on hundreds of records.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how prolific they are. And I think a lot of people just know them from, you know, Africa and Rosanna. But these guys were touching so many albums across so many genres. They're just these incredible musicians. And I really wanted to kind of pull the curtain back to show the artistry, the musicianship, you know, that went into making so many of these songs and give these guys the credit they deserve.
Well, the storytelling is enhanced considerably by a St. Louis guy, a Ferguson guy. He's from right here in the area. That's Michael McDonald. We love him here in St. Louis. But I think even folks who know a lot about Michael McDonald will learn a lot in this movie about everything that he did, not only with the Doobies, but Kenny Loggins and beyond. I mean, his story really is cool. And he's such a great guy, Garrett. Come on. Michael McDonald is the best, right?
I mean, the absolute best. The complete mensch. And, you know, we started calling him the Yacht Father because everything he touched in this space, you know, fits the definition of this music, including, you know, that Doobie bounce he created with the Fender Rhodes piano that has come to define the sound of this music.
So he admits, though, it's funny. He says he didn't get the gig in Steely Dan because of the piano, but because he could sing high. And I was thinking about this even today. There's nobody that sings like Michael McDonald. Nobody. And that's why he got so many, you know, gigs and so many people wanted to collaborate with him.
Absolutely. And these artists, they were so excited to tell their stories about making music in this time period. I think they kind of got skipped over a little bit. I think a lot of us romanticized about the 70s and Los Angeles and the Sunset Strip, and we go straight towards like Laurel Canyon or the Eagles or Fleetwood Mac. Yet on the other side of town, all these incredible musicians were working day and night in this ecosystem of recording studios. And that's what I was interested in doing and exploring that world.
Well, not everyone was extremely excited about exploring it with you. And I don't want to ruin anything from the movie, but I played this clip yesterday and earlier. And this is something that does appear with Donald Fagen from Steely Dan.
Hello, Mr. Fagen.
Yeah, this is he.
Yeah, hi. This is Garrett. I'm the one making this Yacht Rock documentary. So I've been talking to a lot of people that have played with you and Steely Dan over the years. And I was wondering if you'd sit down with me and talk about your music and this genre.
And what genre is that?
Yacht rock.
Oh, yacht rock. Well, I tell you what. Why don't you go f*** yourself?
I think Donald Fagen hung up on me.
Oh, my God. That was epic. Yep. So you couldn't get Donald Fagen. And have you had reactions since the... Because, look, the bottom line is, this is an homage to Steely Dan. It really is.
Yeah, and here's the thing also. After that phone call, they reached out, his team, and said, Donald has granted you the use of all his music in this film. So I think Donald's being Donald Fagen, and it's a wink. He gets it. And none of these guys can deny that this word has brought in a legion of new fans to this music, or allowed people to rediscover this music that might have had abandoned it years ago. I always say, Mark, this music is the soundtrack of our lives, whether we liked it or not, because it was always there. Whether we're grocery shopping or at the doctor's office, the dentist chair, our parents' car, and I think we took it for granted. But I really wanted it to show the artistry and the musicianship and just the incredible talent that went behind making this complex, incredible pop music at the time.
So even on Asia with Peg, this was fascinating to me. And I've, run across a fair amount of musicians who are perfectionists, Bruce Springsteen probably chief among them. But they had seven different solos essentially auditioning for this part in Peg, and they finally decide on one. But man, talk about perfectionists, right? I mean, they were highly demanding and they wanted craftsmanship that was at the top of the game.
Absolutely. I think a lot of these artists that played with Steely Dan took, that mantra of perfectionism into their own work. And I think that's why we kind of create this whole thesis that Steely Dan is the Big Bang of yacht rock, And I think it's important. And once you see those lines drawn, those connections, it makes a whole lot of sense.
Let me play something that is not yacht rock, because this blew my mind, all right? Because I'm a hard rock guy at my core, and this is Ritchie Blackmore playing a solo here with Deep Purple. You're telling me, Garrett, that Christopher Cross happened to be in, where was it, New Orleans? Ritchie Blackmore gets sick, and Christopher Cross, the guy who did Sailing and some of these other songs, filled in for Ritchie Blackmore. That is a true story?
In San Antonio, Texas, Ritchie got sick. Chris was a young kid, basically, guitarist, and he jumped right in there. I mean, Chris is a prolific guitar player. I mean, that solo in Red Like the Wind, you just isolate that, it's pretty remarkable.
You know, there's a couple things that I was left with the impression of. And let me tell you this, too, and this is being honest. I got pretty emotional in parts of this film, Garrett. I don't know if anyone else has told you that, but there's a point where Kenny Loggins and Michael McDonald are telling about how they created What a Fool Believes. And it's a great story, by the way. But I was getting chills, and it almost made me cry. I'm not even making this up, and I don't even know why. But it was so cool to see and to hear these stories.
I love you say that. I've heard that a lot. I think, I think just you see it in their interviews, their passion and how earnest they are about this music they made. And I think they're so appreciative. People are still listening to it. I think a lot of them felt like their careers were over in the mid 80s, and they cannot believe that the resurgence they've had with this music. And it makes a lot of sense just how well produced it is and how it has escapist qualities. And I think it goes against it serves the test of time, right?
It does, but
I think
it's also one of those things, and let me use Africa as an example, because I was a big Toto fan. I played Toto on the radio. Africa and Rosanna are probably two of my favorite songs. But you know what? You think I've admitted that over the decades? You think I told people that I was singing along to Africa with that great chorus in my car? Because I think a lot of us were embarrassed that we liked some of these songs,
right?
Or Chris Cross. And then as they take a bigger piece of culture, maybe we can come to terms with that. But I think I speak for a lot of people in my audience of a certain age. We got a great radio station here in St. Louis, KC95, that broke all these hard rock records, right? And then you start listening to some things that are a little different. You're like, wait a second, am I okay? Is that okay as a fan of rock music to like something that's a little softer, right? So there's an interesting, personal negotiation that I think people experience.
Also, yeah, and I think it's true. It's okay to admit you like this music, I think there's a certain point in your age you get to, you're like, you know what? I don't care if people don't think this is cool or not. I like this music. And, in the age of streaming and Spotify, you don't have to have a record or a CD cover sitting there. So I think you can hide your taste a little bit better now also,
I
don't know.
No,
but,
I think
I'm just
true.
Happy it's getting a second chance, This music, again, has always been there. And I think I'm so happy people are rediscovering it or discovering it for the first time, or there's incredible tribute bands that are carrying on this music too. And there's kids in garages making yacht rock now, which I find fascinating. I think it's really special. It's here to stick.
I'm a big John Mayer fan, and I don't know if you're familiar with his last record, Sob Rock, which was essentially a big wet kiss to, you know, the 80s and some of this music, for sure.
Absolutely. I think we hear these elements in modern music now. That's why I had people like, you know, Questlove and Thundercat and Mac DeMarco and Prince Paul from De La Soul talk about, you know, how important this music was to them in their own work. And I think it got passed over a lot, you know, when you go back in the history of pop music, and it deserves its place on the mantle, I think.
Tell me a little bit more about Thundercat, because Questlove's awesome, but I don't know much about Thundercat, but he was so cool in this movie. I loved him.
Yeah, incredible bassist, kind of a session bassist. I mean, played with Suicidal Tendencies. So he just across all genres, and then started doing his own music. And he was a massive, massive fan of Kenny Loggins and Michael McDonald, as it comes across in his interviews. And he wrote this song that he wanted to bring them both on. And they both sang on it. They played at Coachella. They went on tour together with this music. And, you know, again, he's just one of the many stories that's keeping, you know, this music relevant, I think. And I really appreciate him being a part of it and talking about why this music's so important and what it is.
So what has obviously getting positive reactions. Somebody told me, I don't know if you were on with Chris today, but I think Chris Cross was on CNN. Did you do that interview with him, Garrett?
Yeah. Chris and I got asked to do CNN. They're also appreciative also of getting their music back out there and their stories out there. You know, and I give them major kudos for trusting me to tell their stories. It's not easy as an artist, you know, to hand over your life's work to somebody objectively to tell your story, especially this day and age of documentaries, you know, where the narrative wants to be controlled by so many different people. So, you know, it's exciting, and I'm excited they're reacting positively to the film. They all saw it for the first time only last week. So I had full control to tell the story, and it was an incredible experience showing the film to them all.
So why did you really want to do this? Because your background, I know a little bit about you, but you were involved in some television shows, but not necessarily anything musically. So how did this all start for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I was an editor on a TV series called Daisy Jones and the Six, which was a TV show literally about 1970s Los Angeles. So I was immersed in this culture, but that show was loosely based on Fleetwood Mac. And I became obsessed with this time period. But like I said, I think a lot of people skipped over the studio session guys. So I knew I wanted to tell a story in there. The last documentary I made was on Woodstock 99, which is a bit more of a true crime music story than it was celebrating music. So I wanted to find a project where I showcased the music itself. And coincidentally, I became friends with Christopher Cross's daughter, who, believe it or not, is best friends and roommates with Michael McDonald's daughter. And one night we were at a bar and they said, you should make a documentary about our dads and their relationship with this word, yacht rock, how it's come to define their music 30 years after the fact. I was like, that's a great idea. And, you know, I approached them and said, let's do a film where I give you guys a platform to define your music you were making underneath the umbrella of this word that has kind of bequeathed you so many years later.
I feel like, you know, in a moment like this, when I interview a director or an actor, I don't want to ruin too many things from the movie because I want people to see this, but there's so many of these stories that are so fascinating. Like Chris Cross wrote Ride Like the Wind when he was tripping on LSD. True story, right?
Right. Absolutely. This is after he talks about, the way he made his first demos was selling weed as a pot dealer. You know, I just love these like little tidbits of, you know, behind the music. And these stories that they've never really told before because they've never really had the platform or people have never really asked.
And it's interesting also because that era, you know, because I was on the radio, I started on the radio in 1981 and then I worked for an adult contemporary station after I did some rock in 1985. So Garrett, I played these songs over and over and over again. I thought it was funny because Steve Lukather at one point, you know, because let's be honest, some of these songs are divisive, right? Not everyone loves Steely Dan. Not everyone loves Africa or Toto. Steve Lukather at one point goes, you don't think I'm kind of sick of that song for as many times as I've played it. But it is a unique, you know, era in music, but MTV changed so much because you look at a guy like Chris Cross, who kind of looks like, you know, your everyday American, he didn't look so good on MTV, right? Because these were guys that were just playing their music. They didn't care about the way they looked, but then you had to kind of care about the way you looked.
Yeah, you know, when MTV came along, you know, music got much more multidimensional. It you had to market yourself you know, on screen as much as what the music mattered. So I think, you know, it kind of crowded a lot of these guys out. They didn't want to play that game. You know, it's the true story of video killed the radio star, right, Mark?
It is. Yeah, it really is. Well, listen, I thought this was a very special movie. You know, I said something on the air, and hopefully I didn't really make this a self-fulfilling prophecy, but I admitted on the air earlier that when, Garrett, when I'm super excited about a topic, I remember this with Don Rickles, because I love Don Rickles. Don Rickles actually pulled me up on stage one time at a show, and he wrote a book, and I interviewed him, like, you know, 20 years ago, clearly before he died, and it was just terrible. I was terrible. So I was so excited about this, I figured I'd screw up the interview. But I think I did all right, mainly compared because you did so good.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I'm just so happy people are responding to the film. And, you know, and this music is alive and well. And I hope it sticks around forever because it deserves to be.
It is a great documentary. I've already had a lot of friends that were way ahead of me, and they've seen it. It is on Max right now. Go check it out. Garrett Price, thank you so much. Have a great Christmas, and do another movie like this. You can do a whole movie on Criss Cross, couldn't you?
You absolutely could. I mean, the nuggets I had to leave on the cutting room floor. I appreciate you having me on, Mark.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. I am Ethan Hannaford, filling in as Mark enjoys his time off up until the new year. I'm joined by Sue Thomas, as always. And Sue mentioned it for a moment earlier in the show, but your Steelers, boy, was it a rough day for them yesterday.
Oh, I can't talk about it. And it was at home. It was awful. But I realized that this area is mostly Chiefs fans. I am the outlier. So, you know, congratulations.
I hope that, you know, the Steelers have been a fun team to kind of keep an eye on this year, because they've surprised some people, I think, with, I don't think anyone really expected Russell Wilson
to do this well.
Exactly.
Yes.
I don't think anyone expected him to have the resurgence in his career that he had had. And I think that some people were surprised even that they benched Justin Fields early in the year, because he wasn't doing half bad. You know, they were kind of right around the 500 mark. But yeah, tough loss for the Steelers yesterday. Hopefully the magic is not running out, because in a tough AFC North, this is not the time for the gas to be running low, Sue.
I know, it's really awful. And then, did you watch the Texans game? I didn't watch that at all.
I watched it while I wasn't napping, so I watched the second half, and pretty much by the end of the first half, that game was over.
Just over.
It was an absolute beatdown. 31-2, Baltimore gets the win in that one, and I tell you what, Lamar Jackson, he's making a good argument for MVP, and we'll have to keep an eye on that. If I have to be honest, I think the most entertaining part of that entire game may have been Beyonce's halftime show.
We'll talk
more about it on the other side before we get to Sue's news. Plenty more coming up here in today's Best of Show on the Mark Reardon Show. You're listening on 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.